Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 28th of March. Nice to be back again, except I should have gone south. I didn't go anywhere. I should have gone south last week. It was cold. It's still cold. It's supposed to be warm. Thanks to Veronica Rickert for filling in for me. We're back to all things political today, and our guest is Patrick Marley. The news from Wisconsin just keeps coming, doesn't it? Madison Bureau reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. There was a lot of news late last week. As you know, we don't know, actually. What about Wisconsin's new law that all but eliminates collective bargaining rights for most public employees? Is it in effect today or not? As you know, the Legislative Reference Bureau published the bill on Friday, but there are questions, and there was some talk that there would be people in Madison today going to the courts to say this is not law yet because it's got to go to the state Supreme Court. So what's the story with all of that? We'll certainly ask Patrick that. We have a big election coming up a week from tomorrow already. Craig Gilbert had an interesting article in today's paper asking this question: will people who are concerned about the budget vote in higher numbers than before? Will they vote in higher numbers against Republicans? We'll ask Patrick that as well. So I have a feeling we'll be on these issues for a good chunk of this hour. Our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. David Brooks is joining us the second hour of the program. I looked at the New York Times bestseller list yesterday, and his book is number one already. He has a new book, The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement. And he starts his book with this sentence. How can you not go on after this sentence? This is the happiest story you've ever read. That's a good first sentence, isn't it? This is the happiest story you've ever read. So David Brooks will be joining us, op-ed columnist for the New York Times, and he's frequently on NPR. He's on once a week with E.J. Dionne. So he will be with us. And that's that. Let's get rolling here. We have a lot to talk about. Patrick Marley is our guest. He is Madison Bureau reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Hello, Patrick. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here. So there was word over the weekend that there may be lawyers going to courts this morning to make a final determination as to whether or not this collective bargaining thing is law now or it is not law now. Do you know?
Well, I would not be surprised to see that happen today. You know, this issue is before the Supreme Court, though the Supreme Court hasn't decided whether to take it. So for someone to try to get it at that court or at the local court wouldn't surprise me. There is a hearing tomorrow on this, as it happens in the original case. And so if we don't see any legal action today, I'm sure that that will be front and center in the hearing on Tuesday, which will take up much of the day.
Did this catch everybody's surprise, this being published by the Legislative Reference Bureau?
Yeah, I think that was a total stunner to everybody. Other than those who planned it.
Huh. And would there have been a way for that to not have had happen? How did it happen? Did somebody just think, oh, we can publish it this way?
Well, the Senate Majority Leader, Scott Fitzgerald, went to the Legislative Reference Bureau, pointed to a statute that says that within 10 days of a law being signed, the Bureau needs to publish it, asked them to do that. The director, is a nonpartisan agency, reviewed the statutes, agreed with him, and published it. Now, there's a difference of interpretation. Fitzgerald says that means it became law a day after it was published on Saturday. Steve Miller, the head of the Bureau, said, no, we published the law, but there's something separate that has to happen with the Secretary of State, who's enjoined from doing anything, and that it doesn't become law until he acts.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a big dispute over what it really means that the Reference Bureau published this.
Because it does make a big difference pretty soon now to state workers, doesn't it, in terms of their
sure.
paychecks?
Well, sure. The minute it becomes law, collective bargaining is changed dramatically in the
right.
state. And also state workers and other public employees at the local and school level would have to pay more for their pensions and for their health care.
Right. So they would probably have to pay more in their, April paychecks, but that's...
That was the governor's plan all along, was for this to take effect April 1 on the pension and health care changes.
Mm-hmm.
So we're kind of right on that timeline. This would be the, you know, the first paycheck of April that they'd see those taken out.
Yeah. Well, I wonder what will happen because those paychecks have to be in the works already. So I guess I'm a state worker. We'll just find out. Next week, we'll just find out what the story is.
The day that those checks come out.
Exactly.
We'll know at least where the administration stands on this issue.
Yeah. But the it still goes through the courts. It will still go to the state Supreme Court.
Well, I mean, there's sort of two parallel things. You've got the hearing in Dane County Court. You know, Judge Sumi earlier issued this temporary restraining order that enjoined the Secretary of State from publishing the law in the newspaper, the official state newspaper. Van Hollen appealed that. The appeals court looked at it and said, this is of statewide importance, that we have conflicting past decisions from the Supreme Court, and sent it up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court hasn't said yet whether it's going to take that. Four of the seven justices would have to say that they want to take that. So we don't know what the Supreme Court's going to do. Meanwhile, there's this hearing on the preliminary injunction tomorrow in Judge Sumi's court. So which venue it's going to be in, I'm not really certain. I don't think anybody knows at this point.
And why haven't the Supreme Court justices weighed in on this? Why haven't they said, we're going to take it or we're not going to take it?
Well, that was only Thursday that they were asked to do that. I don't know that that's necessarily, you know, courts tend to move slowly. I don't know that it's necessarily unusual that they wouldn't have decided. They could, you know, they could act at any moment. Whether they'll do it this week, we don't know.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think Fitzgerald took the route that he did? People are still pretty upset about everything that's happened. Why didn't he just let it go through the courts?
Well, I mean, it is true that this, the state statutes, you know, there's sort of two statutes. One says that the Secretary of State must designate a date for publication. And a separate statute says the Legislative Reference Bureau must publish it within 10 days. Now, what they mean by publish is slightly different. It, essentially, when the Reference Bureau publishes it, it's just the official document says on it that it is published, but it doesn't actually get it into the newspaper. So I don't think it really, you know, Fitzgerald looked at that statute and he said, you're supposed to publish this thing. Now the difference is, what does that mean to publish it?
Mm-hmm. We have an election coming up next week. Your colleague Craig Gilbert wrote an interesting piece today asking this question, and I'd like for you to weigh in on. Do you think that there will be people voting in higher numbers? Will they be public employees, unionized employees, who will be voting in higher numbers? Will that make a difference when it comes to next Tuesday's elections?
Well, certainly we saw with the all of the protests in Madison for a month, you know, a high level of public engagement on this issue. As the protests continued, you started to see a lot of, not a lot, but a significant number of signs for Joanne Kloppenburg, who's challenging Justice Prosser. It's clear that those people are very motivated. They've been doing these recall efforts of state senators. But, you know, the other side is trying to recall the Republican state senator. So what turnout is going to look like, I think that's going to be very interesting, because usually we have about 20% in an April election. If it's, I think, a higher level than that of turnout is probably spells trouble for Justice Prosser. But I think it's really hard to pinpoint what kind of turnout you have in these elections generally. And this is really a test of those people opposed to this law to see if they're going to come to the polls.
Mm-hmm.
That said, there seems to be a lot of the people opposed to collective bargaining who are treating this election as a litmus test or a referendum on that law. Both the candidates for the court don't see it that way and don't think that those parallels should be drawn.
But they're going to be. They may say that, but of course they're going to be.
Yeah, I think that's probably true if there's big turnout. If turnout is, you know, your typical spring voter base, then I don't think it's that kind of referendum. It's just your people who always go to the polls in the spring for local elections and for court races.
Yeah. Let's talk about the ads for that race. It's striking to me there seem to be a lot of anti-Prosser ads on television here in the Milwaukee area. There are very few ads for her that define who she is. They're all anti-Prosser ads. Is she running some ads, or has she decided not to do that? And who's running all the anti-Prosser ads?
Well, both sides are very limited in how much they can spend. For the candidates themselves, both are participating in public financing. They got $100,000 in the primary of taxpayer money. They got $300,000 in the general election. That is not a lot of money for a statewide campaign.
No, it's not.
If you think about, you know, how much gets spent in a race for governor or U.S. Senate, I mean, it's millions and millions of dollars, sometimes $10, $13 million. So you can't do much of an ad buy with that kind of money. They've both been on TV. I know Joanne Kloppenburg has a radio ad right now. I think Prosser has a television ad on right now. Kloppenburg may as well. But those are going to be drowned out by the outside groups that are spending. Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce has an ad supporting Prosser. The Greater Wisconsin Committee has two ads that are anti-Prosser. They're very tough ads in terms of their sentiment. We haven't seen yet anything anti-Kloppenburg with a week out. I wouldn't be surprised if we see something like that eventually, but so far she has not been targeted that way.
And are there other races that are of statewide importance, Patrick?
That's the only statewide race that's on the ballot. There's, you know, another interesting thing about turnout is you've got all these local races. There's the Milwaukee County executive race, which is going to have a lot of interest. That's an open seat. Dane County executive is an open seat. You've got a very contentious Madison mayor's race. Racine County and Outagamie County also have county executive races where there's no incumbent. So you have a lot of pockets around the state, high population areas that are going to have big turnout for local races. How that spills over into the court race, I think it's hard to tell.
Mm-hmm. And what about various recall elections of Democratic senators, Republican senators? Where is the movement on that?
Well, they're all, I think they're about 30 days into their 60-day signature gathering process. They've got to get 25% of the number of they've got to get signatures equivalent to 25% of the votes cast in the race for governor for that district. That's a high threshold. You know, we're talking 12 to 22,000 votes in each Senate district, depending on what turnout was like. But obviously, you know, in normal times, it'd be very difficult to get. Now all sides seem to concede that there's going to be a lot of recall elections, that people are going to be able to get those numbers of signatures. Then I think we're going to get really bogged down in this review period. The Government Accountability Board is responsible for reviewing those, making sure that they've got the numbers and that they're, you know, the signatures are proper. And then the other side can challenge those. Well, if you turn in 22,000 signatures, you can make a lot of challenges to it, and then you've got to determine, you know, is this person who they say they are? Is this person really live at this address? Did this person sign their own sheet? Does this person live in the district? You multiply that times 16.
Oh, my gosh, right.
And you've got a lot of, you know, administrative tasks at hand. And so I think normally the review period is 4 weeks or 6 weeks, something like that. But that can be extended, and I would expect that will be extended. It's unclear if it'll be extended just in select races or in a bunch of races. So, you know, we could have elections as early as June or July, but they could also be pushed well into the fall.
Mm-hmm. So you would say that most people collecting signatures have it in mind to collect many more than the needed number of signatures just to make sure that their challenges aren't all thrown out?
Sure. I mean, that's the goal of anybody, anytime mm-hmm. you're gathering signatures, you know, even to get on the ballot, if you get 200 signatures, you try to get 400. If you need to get 22,000 signatures, yeah, you want to get as many as you can, but it's hard to get even 22. So I guess we'll see, you know, how high a numbers they can turn in.
Let's go to phone calls momentarily. It's All Things Political for this Monday, and Patrick Marley is our guest, Madison Bureau reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. It's certainly a sign of the times that we've decided to devote again a good chunk of this hour to what's going on in the state of Wisconsin, because it's rather dramatic, and that's where people people's interest seems to be right now. But you can certainly comment if you want on some of the other national or international stories. To your phone calls momentarily, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and a couple lines are open, so grab them. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, we'll be speaking with David Brooks. He has a new book, The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement. And he synthesizes many decades of scientific research into a narrative grounded in everyday life. He takes us through the lives of two people who are invented characters, Harold and Erica, and follow them from infancy to school, from the Odyssey years that have come to define young adulthood to the high walls of poverty, from the nature of attachment, love, and commitment to the nature of effective leadership. So he will be with us the second hour of our program. To your phone calls, our number 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And we start our calls with Patty in Eau Claire. Hello, Patty.
Hello, good morning. I'd like your guest to address something. I keep hearing the accusation that the rush by the governor to get all of this passed and to thwart the restraining order and everything else is really designed to gut the financial base of the Democratic Party, which I find very disturbing and distressful. I'd like to see more than two parties being viable anyway. Yeah, I'd like to hear your guest comment on that. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Patty.
Yeah, I don't think that the accusation is necessarily that it's the rush over what's been done on the restraining order and that. I think the accusation is just that the base of the law, the very reason that he did it, was to affect the Democratic Party's fundraising ability. The governor says that's not true. The fact is that unions, public employee unions, often endorse Democratic candidates, often provide them with significant amounts of money or provide funding to groups that then go on to support Democrats or court candidates that Democrats tend to support. So that's certainly a background here. You know, the unions would no longer be able to get their dues through the state. Right now, you belong to the union, and the state just deducts that money from your paycheck and hands it over to AFSCME or other public employee unions. The state would no longer be able to do that under this law. And if you look to a state like Indiana, where they did something similar, union membership dropped off dramatically. That leaves less money for the unions to do not only their bargaining and things that they do for union members, but also their political donations.
Right.
But the governor, to be clear, says that's not his motivation here.
However, Senator Fitzgerald did say on Fox News that it would play a huge role in the reelection or the not re-election of President Obama, to not have that money.
That is right. That is correct. He did say that this would make it easier for the Republican candidate to win in Wisconsin for the presidential election.
Thank you very much for the call. We go to Hugh in Milwaukee next. Hi, Hugh.
Hi. I come originally from another state, and in that state, when you had a primary, if there were 10 candidates, if one candidate got not a plurality, but a majority, more than 50%, then there was no need for a runoff. And it's sad to see that, in the primary, Justice Prosser got 55% of the vote. He got a majority of the vote. Kothenberg only got 25%. And yet we have to spend waste money on a runoff. I would strongly urge a changing of the law. B, happily, there is a legislature which can change laws, and we have a governor who can sign them. Unfortunately, we have Democratic judges and district attorneys and left-wing Madison that is trying to obstruct the will of the people of Wisconsin. The people, most people are not protesting and squatting in the state house. Most people are not insulting and threatening legislators. Most people voted for Walker and the Republicans. And the obstruction of democracy and the people's will by the Democrats and their tyrannical judges, I think people should wake up. I hope we vote Republican next week.
But, Hugh, there are Democrats, I'm sure you know, who feel that the Republicans have obstructed the democratic process by becoming the majority and doing things that the Democrats didn't think they were going to do, or some Republicans thought. So it goes both ways, don't you think?
Well, look, as a union member, I don't like my money going to ask me who gives it to Obama and the Democrats. Why should I have to help put up ads that I don't agree with? You know what I mean? The unions are Democratic Party outlets, basically. And, if you want to be a union member, or if you have to, if your dues are deducted, whether you want them want that or not, you're stuck with it.
Patrick.
The court comments are interesting because, think about the federal health care law. That is something that the Democrats pushed through when they controlled Congress, outraged Republicans, and is now in several federal courts. This is just the flip of that. You've got Republican control of a state legislature, a Republican governor. They were able to get something through that Democrats hate, and now they're challenging it in court. There's a little bit of a difference in that right now the challenges to the law are over the manner in which it was passed. I think that it is very likely to happen soon that we see challenges. Actually, we do have now a new court challenge that challenges the substance of the law. But it's not surprising when you have big change through a legislative body to have the opponents of it go to the court system, which, under our system of government is the checks and balances. At the end of this process, in both for both federal health care and for collective bargaining in Wisconsin, it's clear that the courts will be the ultimate determiner of what happens.
I would have to disagree that the health care law was the flip of this, though. That health care law was debated vociferously for at least a year. There was widespread agreement among, I remember doing shows with people from business and Republicans and Democrats who were very, very concerned about the rate of premiums, the amount of money that businesses were having to pay. And it did go through, and the president ran on this. He ran on the issue that there was going to be a change in health care. What was different about this is that it happened so rapidly. We were talking a matter of days here that this happened, and nobody saw it coming.
Well, surely there are significant differences. I guess the point I was trying to make is that, opponents of the collective bargaining law feel very strongly and very passionately, much as opponents of federal health care feel very strongly and very passionately. You talk to people on either side of that, those issues, and the level of their opinions of it is about the same point. Mm. Clearly, there are huge differences between, they're totally different areas of law, and as you point out, the debates took place in very different ways.
Thanks, Hugh, for your call. We go next to Teresa in Viroqua. Hi, Teresa. Whoa,
hi.
Teresa, where are you? Hi.
Hi, I'm here.
Okay.
I haven't seen a whole lot of this in the press. I mean, it's been interesting to catch a lot of news more on YouTube than in the actual press. But the courts have issued orders about protesting going on in the Capitol, and they've permitted that in the rotunda. And yet the governor continues to issue administrative rules to try to circumvent and bypass the court's rulings on these issues and bypass the Constitution of the United States. I mean, just this weekend, they ticketed a couple of children because they were holding a sign in the rotunda, which is a permitted area. It was perfectly legal for them to be there. And yet the police there have said that they have been told by the administrative department there at the Capitol to ticket people. And they're now, in fact, taking people down to the police station to book them for protesting and exercising their First Amendment rights perfectly legally. So I'm curious as to your guest thoughts on that.
This issue over the access to the Capitol, the ability to protest in the Capitol, that is another one that's going to be fought out in court. There, you know, we have saw thousands and thousands of people in the Capitol on some days. In the midst of that, the administration sort of changes policy and put pretty significant limits on your ability to get in and out of the Capitol. At one point, you could only get in if you were going to a public hearing or you were designated as a constituent of a legislator, and you had to be come down and met at the door, and it was very hard to get into the building, even for employees of the building, even for press who routinely worked there. This led to a lawsuit by AFSCME, and that led to the judge's decision that required the Department of Administration to make the building more open, but also gave them clear authority to arrest people to get them out when the building closed. That never really happened. They were able to get people out voluntarily, but they had people who were camping in the Capitol for 2 weeks. It's very clear now that we're going to have sort of an extended legal action over that. I mean, that case is continuing, and you've got people who are going to be challenging just what you're talking about. You know, the police and administration have essentially said there are just certain areas of the Capitol in which you can protest with signs, not supposed to go to other areas. There's a much smaller number of protesters now. You know, now on a daily basis, you have maybe a dozen people who are in the Capitol on a sustained basis, holding up signs, yelling, doing their protesting, much different than when we had hundreds and thousands of people there. But they are tickets are being issued from time to time as people go up onto the first floor holding signs. The police go up to them, "You're not supposed to be here. Please go to the right area." Those people are making their point that it's the Capitol. They should be able to petition their government, and they shouldn't have restrictions on this. They're getting tickets. You know, I'm sure that those are going to be challenged either separately or as part of this main case. So that's another one, and we just have to kind of wait and see where the courts fall.
Well, I think the interesting thing is that the courts have ordered that people can peacefully protest in the rotunda, and it's the governor and the administrative offices that are trying to circumvent those orders once again by overriding things. They don't have authority to override the court, and yet they're trying to. They don't have authority to override the Constitution, and yet they're trying to. These people are in the rotunda where they're permitted to be by the court order, and the governor is once again disregarding that, as well as many laws he's disregarding. So I think he thinks that he is the law.
Thanks, Teresa, very much for your call.
Thank you.
It is, when you think about it, pretty extraordinary what's happened in Wisconsin the last month, isn't it? Patrick, it is just extraordinary.
Well, it's historic. I mean, nobody could guess these many twists and turns that have happened here from, the scope of the law that was proposed. It's a huge change. The Democrats leaving the state, that I don't think anybody saw that coming. The ability for thousands of people to come to the Capitol, not just, you know, for a Saturday rally, but every day for 3 weeks. This hasty calling of a conference committee, the issues surrounding that of whether there was proper notice and proper access, getting the bill through, the 60-plus hour debate in the state assembly when they did the original version of the bill, this fake Koch brothers call, now this issue of publishing the law. I mean, there's just you just never know when you come into work each day what curveball is going to be thrown at you.
Exactly, and your Monday has only just begun.
Yes.
Right. Hal from Washburn, hi.
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 I have a question about the Senate recalls. I've been able to find out how many signatures are needed in each of the districts, but I can't find out how many signatures they've already collected. Is there any place that I could go to find out how many of those signatures are already collected?
No, there's not. The groups, I mean, other than going to the groups and asking them, which, I've heard numbers along the way, but you never know whether you can trust them because, you know, people say they have these numbers. Do they really have those numbers? What's the quality of those signatures? You know, have they accidentally gotten signatures from a bunch of people who are out of the district, or, you know, not filled out the proper forms? There's very specific rules about how you gather these signatures. There does seem to be pretty wide agreement by both sides that the efforts are going well and that they are gathering signatures at a quick pace. For instance, Senator Dan Capanke, a Republican in the La Crosse area, very quickly said, "It's clear I'm going to have an election."
Really?
That's the race that the Democrats or the public workers, those who are trying to do the recall, feel most confident in terms of their ability to force an election and win that seat. So I think we're going to see a lot of recalls. I don't know.
As it gets toward, you know, the time deadline, do you expect that the paper will have some information to the public on that?
Well, we'll publish as soon as we hear, as soon as they turn in signatures, we'll be reporting on that.
Good.
Absolutely.
Well, I appreciate this. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Hal.
Thank you.
John in Lake Geneva. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, John.
Yes, I agree with the man that was a union member. And the thing that bothers me is that why should the state be required, or why should the state under any circumstances collect any type of dues from any type of organization? It seems to me that that's not a state function. That's number one. Number two is that we in Wisconsin are always trying to get businesses in here, and yet businesses have to collect union dues and turn them over to the union to fight the company. This to me seems just out of all reason. The third thing I want to say is that I understand that there is an organization, and I believe it's in California, that has been trying to get the recall signatures. And then the fourth one is that we have so many people outside of the state of Wisconsin that have come in here who feel that they have the right to help, quote, help, unquote, the Wisconsin people. I don't think the Wisconsin people need that kind of help. And third, my son just came back from Washington, D.C., and he had a very difficult time just getting into the Capitol to see inside the Capitol, let alone demonstrate in there. I'll hang up and listen to what you have to say. Thank you.
All right, John.
Let's see. You raised a few points there. One, on the access to the Capitol, it's not as restrictive as it had been at certain points during the protests. Still, there are just a couple of doors of the many doors of the Capitol that are open. You do go through police screening. Oftentimes have to go through a metal detector to get in there. It takes a couple of minutes, but you can get into the Capitol relatively easily compared to at times when, you know, they were literally... You had to have specific reasons to get into the Capitol. He raised the point about the number of people outside the state trying to influence recalls.
Mm-hmm.
Keep in mind the people who sign these things have to live in the Senate district and be an eligible voter. So it is true that there's a lot of involvement of people in these efforts, but the people who are going to decide whether there's a recall or not have to be voters from those particular districts. There is a Utah-based group that is helping to try to recall all of the Democratic senators on the attempt to recall the Republicans. You can imagine that there's a lot of national union interest in doing that, and that there's a fair bit. And we're going to see money from both sides. We're already starting to see money from both sides pour in from out of state. There's no question about that, but that happens in, to some extent in governor's races, certainly happens in U.S. Senate races. And then he was raising points about
union dues.
Employers collecting the union dues. That is pretty standard for both public sector and private sector unions. You know, when they sit down at the negotiating table, they have to work out all manners of a labor contract. Is pretty standard for unions to have sought years and years ago that the employer collect the dues on behalf and then give it over the unions. Obviously, it makes things much easier for the union. I think that's something that's been going on, you know, whether you oppose it or support it. It's been something that's happened for decades in both the public and private sector.
Stephen LaCrosse, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, okay.
I've got two comments. One is someone just called about having people arrest the sign in the rotunda. And my one of my questions would be is, let's say someone wore a T-shirt that said impeach the radical reds, and referring, of course, to the Republicans. Would a T-shirt count as that also, where you could get cited if you wore something on your clothing?
I would be very surprised if that happened.
I mean, what's the difference between that and a sign?
You know, that's a good question. I would, you know, I don't know how many people have been cited. There have been a few people who have been cited outside of the rotunda. Your earlier caller said that there were people cited in the rotunda. I haven't heard of that happening.
Okay.
The people who have been cited are trying to make a point, you know, are sort of intentionally defying the police on a an attempt to make a First Amendment point that they should be able to protest where they want in the Capitol.
Right.
It doesn't always work. I mean, Ben Mazel is sort of a well-known protester here in Madison. The other day, he came into the press room in the Capitol and said, "I'm going to go get ticketed. You know, you all watch me." And he went down. And he stood next to the state constitution. He held a big sign that said, "This is a test of the emergency First Amendment system," or something like that, a free speech system. And he stood around, and he had, you know, a few of his friends and supporters there watching him, and the police kind of eyed him and walked around. And you know, he waited 10 minutes, and nobody would give him a ticket. There are other people though who've been doing things, and they certainly have gotten tickets. So it's it kind of depends what happens in each individual.
I guess it depends if this camera's around. Anyway, I've got a second comment that I'd like to make, and that is, I understand that, you know, the uproar over collective bargaining rights and everything, but I think a more important aspect is, and I've read a couple of editorials on this, most recent one was yesterday in the La Crosse Tribune, was on the Voter ID Act. And matter of fact, the La Crosse Tribune, I was really surprised because they came out and they call it the Voter Exclusionary Act, which seems to me that's pushed way back on the burner on a real low flame. And I'm afraid that one, when it comes through, is just going to slide right through. And basically what it's saying, you know, we really don't need photo IDs, I don't believe, for elections. And it's primarily what they've cited is that maybe in the last 15 years, I think they said there were 27 instances of maybe people that voted that shouldn't be, but most of those were felons that didn't realize that they hadn't had their civil rights either restored or taken away from them.
What is the story on that bill?
The bill has been passed by the Senate. It's awaiting action in the Assembly. It's very clear that some version of it will pass. This is an issue that's very important to Republicans. They've been campaigning on it for years. I don't think anybody should have any doubt that they will be able to pass that bill and will pass that bill. One interesting aspect of it is the Senate passed the bill at a time that the Democrats were out of state. And the version that they passed required that for 2011 elections, they ask you for your ID, but if you don't have it, you can still vote. And they'd tell you, starting January 1, 2012, elections after that, you're going to have the ID. But right now, to show that we're just asking people so they sort of get ready for it. What's interesting about that is to see whether they change that aspect of the law, because at the time they passed it, I don't think anybody thought there'd be more than a couple of local elections in 2011. Now it's very likely that we'll have 16
right.
recall elections.
Exactly.
Are they going to keep that in place, or are they going to require that the photo ID goes into place right away?
And somebody had a question about the fee for this. This is an email that's come in. I have heard that state IDs would be free. Currently, they cost $28. Would this be a change, or would a free ID actually cost $28? And would a person without a permanent address be able to vote?
IDs would be free. Now, state ID would be free under the law. You'd have to pay for a driver's license, but if you wanted to just get an ID, which is, I'll take them at their word that it's $28, that sounds about right, you just go to the DMV and prove your residency, you can get it. Can somebody without a fixed address, I would imagine that there would be a way for that person to get an ID. I don't know how they handle that. Currently, you know, homeless people can vote if they're if they qualify. I don't know how under the Constitution you could deprive somebody the right to vote just because they didn't have a home. I don't know what mechanism they take to deal with that. I'd be surprised if they don't address that in some fashion.
All Things Political is what you are listening to here on the Ideas Network, and our guest is Patrick Marley, Madison Bureau reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. A reminder tonight at 6 o'clock, maybe it's not a reminder, maybe this is the first time you're hearing this, NPR News is going to provide special coverage of President Obama's speech on the U.S. and NATO's military operation in Libya. This will be tonight, and it's at 6 o'clock. Special coverage by NPR here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, David Brooks will be with us, and he has a new book, The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement. So that's hour number two of the show. Let's go back to phone calls for Patrick. Mike in Appleton, hi.
Yeah, good morning. echoing one of your previous callers, and then your guest made a comment that in Indiana, I believe he said, where similar laws had been passed, that the enrollment in unions fell dramatically. And so, I mean, that doesn't seem to make much sense, because if unions are such a good thing, you would think that the enrollment would stay the same. And I'd possible.
I'm sorry, we missed a word of that. You what?
I would like a follow-up, if possible.
Patrick.
Sure. In 2004 or 2005, I think 2005, the new governor in Indiana, Mitch Daniels, virtually eliminated collective bargaining. I don't know if they still have some form of it left. Their collective bargaining was different than Wisconsin in that it was created by an executive order in 1989 by a previous governor. So all it took to get rid of it was the act of the governor. You didn't need the legislature to act here. We've got it in state law. So it was, and also they didn't have quite the level of collective bargaining that we do in Wisconsin. So the issue of membership plummeting in Indiana, you've got to keep in mind that there wasn't really anything a union could do for you anymore. I think it would be harder to make the case for someone to say, why should I pay for a union if there's not a lot that they can do? We don't have negotiating, at least like what we had in the past. So there'd be less incentive for somebody to join. In Wisconsin, under this law, unions would still exist. They would still be able to bargain over wages, so there would be a back and forth with unions. To what extent they would be able to maintain their membership, I guess, is unknown, though I think it would be much harder for them because of the issue of how they deduct dues, or they would stop doing that.
The Journal Sentinel had an interesting article on Mitch Daniels. Let me ask you, yesterday's paper, I believe, do you think that he's the governor who's writing the playbook on what's happening in Wisconsin and Ohio and Michigan and Indiana?
Well, I think he was certainly on the front lines of that. I mean, he was, clearly Governor Scott Walker has gotten a bigger fight on his hands than Mitch Daniels did, and I think part of that is because unions are more entrenched here in state government. They've been around longer. They had more rights, and you had to push this through the legislature. But I think that Governor Walker would say that, you know, he took some cues from Mitch Daniels on that. He clearly watched what happened and mm-hmm. saw that as a good thing and something that he wanted to pursue.
Yeah. Let's go to Dan in Milwaukee. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Kathleen. You had an earlier caller, I suspect, the conservative, asking about outside influences. I don't really think there is such a thing as a local election anymore, and there hasn't been for some time. And I think the influences, of course, are on both sides. So I just had to say something. It's not a one-sided situation here. This is standard operating procedure, and we're probably in campaign mode 365
right,
days a year,
right.
Every year.
Isn't that the truth, Patrick? We are in campaign mode all the time. It gets a little tedious, don't you think?
We are in sort of nonstop campaigns, and that's going to be especially true with these recalls. I mean, I think that you know, you can see it just from having the November election to having the April Supreme Court election, which got more politicized by these changes to collective bargaining. So you already had that sort of feeling of the permanent campaign. You see, you know, Scott Walker ran for governor for at least 2 years, and you could make the case for longer because he was in the previous campaign and dropped out and sort of quickly started touring the state. Presidential campaigns seem to be perennial with these recalls. If we have elections scattered throughout 2011, yes, you're gonna feel like those ads telling you that the people running your government are horrible are never gonna end.
Mm-hmm. We had an email wanting you to comment on what the latest is from the Journal Sentinel on Saturday. A top Republican Party of Wisconsin official has asked the University of Wisconsin-Madison under the state's open record laws to produce emails written by a prominent history professor, an apparent response to a blog post the professor wrote about a conservative group. Can you give us the latest, if you know what it is, on UW-Madison Professor Cronin's story?
Yeah, I can't talk a lot about that because that's not a story I've been covering, so I've just seen what you've had. But, you know, he wrote a blog about this group called ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is a group that has meetings and for state legislators around the country and talks to them about legislation that they think that would be good. A lot of those ideas get brought to Wisconsin and other states, introduced. It's a conservative group. He wrote about this shortly after that. Someone from the state Republican Party asked for, through the open records law, his emails looking for information about recalls and about unions and about specific state senators. The professor reacted strongly to that and sees it as an intimidating move and has written extensively about that. That's gotten a lot of national attention. I don't believe he's produced any records yet, but it has been, I guess, you know, we'll sort of see where it goes from here. The Republican Party has said, look, the open records law is open to anybody, and the citizens of the state are welcome to ask for the emails of public employees, and we don't have to tell you why, and we don't have to tell you what we do once we get them.
Yeah. It's interesting they would go after this guy, though, because he's about to become, I believe, the head of the American Historical Society. So just wanted to make that point.
Sure.
Yeah, thanks, Dan, very much for your call. Let's go next to Gay. Gay on the road. Hi, Gay.
Yeah, hi. I have to give you just an anecdotal and non-scientific kind of poll, but I just took the city of New Orleans, that wonderful train.
Oh, you did?
Orleans,
oh, great.
And I'm wearing my red T-shirt. And I admit that train riders are a self-selected group because they're people who don't mind talking and mixing it up with other people. That's why they take this leisurely route of getting down there. But it was terrific. And I was wearing my red T-shirt, Wisconsin 14 T-shirt, which I'm going to change to Wisconsin 13 T-shirt. But I was wearing it, and people would approach me if they wanted to talk politics, and they would knew, and they were from everywhere, Arizona, Michigan, all over the place, and they wanted to know. They said, what is happening in Wisconsin? I would tell them my side of it, and clearly I'm partisan, but they were really concerned, and they all knew a lot more than, you know, I thought they might about it, and were, and my unscientific poll, 9 to 12 in favor of what we were doing. The last person I talked to, and very few were from Wisconsin, by the way, but when they were really excited to see the T-shirt. The last person I talked to was a Republican who is a judge, so he said, I can't be a Republican when I'm a judge, but I am a Republican. But he said, I'm very disturbed by what's going on. And I sort of stiffened up, and he said, because it means, in a sense, the death of a long tradition in this country, in which when the majority is in power, they still respect the rights of the minority. And he said, I think it's a very bad move for both sides because the majority will become the minority, you know, over the years. And anything, any terrible plan that's put into place will eliminate that necessary kind of check and balance on absolute power. And he was very articulate, and I, you know, while we disagreed on the particulars of this case, he was so wise, I thought. And, you know, we found ourselves good friends because we could respect the other's position.
All right. Thank you, Gay, very much for the call. It is interesting to think about what will happen, because eventually there will be a change of some kind. Democrats will hold some branch of government, perhaps, and it will be interesting to see what happens down the road. But at the moment, it's hard to imagine what's going to happen down the road, Patrick, isn't it?
It is hard to tell. I mean, I think there is a problem with sort of between the Republicans and the Democrats in the legislature, in that, you know, that there usually is this recognition of, you know, you can treat the minority party poorly, but you don't want to treat them poorly because someday you'll be back there yourself. And this is especially true in the Senate, which has flipped control a lot over the last 10 or 15 years. You know, the Assembly just went back to the Republicans.
Right.
But other than that two-year period that the Democrats held it, the Republicans held it for a long time.
We have to say goodbye. We're out of time. Thank you, Patrick, so much for being with us. Patrick Marley, Madison Bureau reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We thank Rhonda Fanning for producing this show, Chrissy Pease for on-air production, and want to let you know that next Monday, this is hard to believe, we're going to be broadcasting all things political from Studio 4A at NPR in Washington. Our Washington trip with listeners starts this Wednesday. Ken Rudin will be one of our guests.